Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Masonic Companion on the 9th day of February, 6014 Anno Lucas. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for coming. We've got a pretty good show ahead, I think. I have a question. You know, as usual, take advantage of the fact I have an audience of advisors and consultants out there. A man is walking through the recreation ground of his local park when he notices a huge fight going on in the football pitch. What's going on? Asks a spectator watching from the side. And the other one says, it's a match between the Masons and the Knights of Columbus. The first guy says, well, what's the score? And the fellow answers, I don't know. It's a secret. I love this stuff. Dear. That was, no, all right. That was from times gone by. That's okay. I'm reading a list here from old jokes. This is one from St. Andrew Lodge in Norway. And this was on a cup found in a lodge in Ireland. Old Masons never die, but you'll have to join to find out why. That's pretty much the truth, I would say. we have much going on today in the world. Our attention is turned away. This is like a bit of a breather for the world, if people choose to use it that way. It's when we step back from our tendency to fight with each other and to find fault, sadly, we are an intelligent enough race, species, that we can, and we're quarrelsome. And I think that's a product of our, you can say it's certainly not, but we're bright enough that in any kind of encounter or any kind of conflict, we can find, if men and women choose to, we can find reasons to fight. We can find more reasons to blame our shortcomings and our indifference on other people. And I don't think, there was a sect in Greece that said, you notice that dogs don't do that. Either there may be a dog that's that's sick. But generally, you know, if there's a conflict, it's established by the hierarchy of the pack. With mankind, we seem to all want to think that we're alpha. Nobody's alpha. I think that was a concept that was tripe, and a lot of people bought into it because it's fed into their suppositions and their needs. I'm the alpha. Yeah. Okay. So we collectively, mankind needs these moments of pause, and then it's incomplete, isn't it? Because of communication. Remember, if there was a battle going on in the 16th and 17th century, it would take perhaps a good month or even more for the news of the battle and the victor, or the outcome of the battle, to be shared with anybody. And for somebody like my station in life to find out, well, nobody really thought it was important for somebody in other than the decision makers to know what was going on in the world. Other people were making decisions for us. We fought very long and hard for the freedoms, for that flow of information, for the individual to be able to make the decisions about what is and what isn't important. But that gets us to what the Greeks taught us, the tyranny of the majority, or the tyranny of the minority as well, the populace. Vox populi. If that's dumbed down, then we're all subject to some pretty clumsy, pretty thoughtless ideas. And I'm reminded, I just finished Bethany Hughes' book on the Hemlock Cup. Excellent read. By the way, if you're looking for a read on, if you ever wondered about the Peloponnesian Wars and what they were, the Greeks, the Greeks were an interesting bunch. She wrote about Socrates, of course, and what the Athenians did with him after they sentenced him to death. It was nonsense when you look at the reasons. But the way that things are, the 50 judges that made the decisions were elected from those that showed up. Well, you know, they had a sort of a cattle call, like they would for positions in a play. And you would be given a little ball, and the distribute whether you got one or not to be selected was determined by a device that a very very basic computing device. So nobody really knew, it wasn't in the hands of a person. So this device would randomly assign these little balls, and you would step forward. So 50 judges of that kind, the qualification had nothing to do with it, because this kind of election process was the same as how the generals were elected. Yeah. So you think, you know, you could do better? History doesn't exactly favor that kind of thinking. Truly. If you feel that every single person has legitimate responsibilities, this is the way the Greek first democracy was set up, 5th century stuff. And we learned a considerable amount, because it errors and complications that we don't necessarily want to repeat. Anyway, we saw what they did with him. They sentenced him and convicted him. And shortly after he died, the Athenians realized what they had done. That execution is the approved murder of a person. So they had murdered him, and there you have it. They were building statues and commemoratives to him within years of his death. They realized there had been a realization. You killed him off. What did you kill? So if you're a fan of every person having a say and you take what comes, well, good luck, I say to you. Good luck. On the other hand, if you're looking at having people well qualified to advise us, as we want to believe we have here in this country, Well, the key to that, of course, is accountability. History, again, teaches it. Good Masons know this, and I'm just sharing things you all know. If there is anybody given an authority, they need to be held accountable. Absolutely. Or they become overbearing. History teaches us that. Time and time again. We don't have to relearn that lesson. So this isn't a matter of trust. It's a matter of what happens to a person's thinking when they are given a little bit of power. Changes a person. Yep, it does. So we like to emphasize the unpleasantness of a moral rudder, don't we? Men of conscience and accountability and answering for your behaviors and your actions. And now we're exposing in the 21st century, we're exposing a lot of lying and deceit. People of authority are now being caught out. Everybody is taking pictures of everything and recording everything. So if you're a liar, if you're a deceiver, if you're taking advantage of your rank, you're going to be caught. Isn't that a scary thought? We may not have all the answers in the world, but it looks like we're being collectively, we have the little tools around us that are demonstrating, revealing honesty. So no matter, especially if you're a braggart, especially if you're somebody that wants to abuse your positions of authority, those private encounters when you think you can beat somebody because you have an authority or you can justify it. This is where I claim we have the intelligence. This is an intelligence problem because all of these acts, contrary to the rules, are by people thinking they can get away with it. But more insidious is people thinking that they can convince themselves that they're right. That's the danger. That's the danger. So you go about your business, keep an eye out. Just keep your wits about you. We don't call that suspiciousness. We call that maturity, wisdom, experience. Suspiciousness is when you're doing it with everybody all the time. So that brings me back to my original point for today's show. The world has taken a big step back if they're using their intelligence constructively. And watching the Olympics, and we can look at it if we have to, if you're narrow, and say this is an organized form of conflict. Well, gee, really? You can't tell the difference between conflict and competition, hey? And then we come along and say, oh, competition's cool. It's fine. It's absolute. It's fun. Because we have this notion in Canada of sportsmanship. We don't embarrass somebody. We don't directly run the score up when we know that one side is, not unless you're a thick-headed moron, you know? We know what it feels like when you're on the losing side. And so we don't want to remove the dignity of that fellow. So we know how to help people save face. And it also brings a dignity to the whole encounter. Now, keep the politicians and politics out of it and keep the people with their own agenda out of it. You know, over here we have to make that country look bad, don't we? Everything they do at every turn. Every country can be made to look bad at every move. Everything we do, everything we can say. You and I as Freemasons are certainly an example of that. We know the harsh reality of what can be done of twisting meaning. But if we look at things prima facie, look at them as they are, the majority of people are in the planet are trustworthy. They want the same things you and I want. They want to be able to get by the best way they can. They want to be able to raise their families and live in harmony with their neighbors. Now, that's hard to unravel sometimes. Man, I didn't say this is easy. But the majority of people underneath it all, that's where they're coming from. So do we have knuckleheads? You already know the answer to that. Do we have people doing strange things That's why we have accountability, don't we, boys and girls? Do we need accountability? Do we need somebody to keep an eye on the knuckleheads? I won't even see. I'm bringing my own mirth to the program. Are you kidding? I can't say that with a straight face. But that one's obvious. Anyway, enough on that. Enjoy the Olympics for what they are. Not what somebody's trying to make them into. Not somebody's private little conversation, you know, meager little thought. Enjoy the competition. This is the best the world has to offer. And it gives us a chance to not whine and not complain. That's all you're hearing day by day. You're going to start to believe that that's all that there is. It takes, you and I do have a role in all of that. We can step away. We can turn our heads to the stars, turn our glance to the stars. We can be the lions of industry and the creative genius and dreamers. We don't have to be greed. You know, let the marketplace determine the rules. Really, the marketplace is skewed and tilted to your advantage. That's even in Vegas. You better go to Vegas, buddy. The odds are stacked in favor of the house. Hey, that's just statistics. That's mathematics. That's nothing to do with your genius. So if you're able to tap into that, you're always going to make a profit. Yeah. So we'd like to make our accountability. This tells us we want to make sure that there's a redistribution so that there's some sense of equity. I don't think it should matter whether a person has an oligarch or not to be able to enjoy improved quality of life. I hear in Canada, we're so new at it. We're getting around to that. But man, even more so, methodically, we're getting around to it. This is just fascinating times to be a Mason, a Freemason, to hear the timid. I'll be kind here, lamenting all of this so-called newness going on around us. That's never changed. It's always been that way. The world is like that. No matter what you're doing, it would be a new, better, sharper edge, a new tool, a new telescope. There's always been new, clever ideas. And if you didn't use clever ideas, you were so much the fool, hey? Oh, my goodness, you know, a clever idea proved wrong. Oh, there's a justification for not using anything. Only if you're stupid. Only if you're stupid. Things happen. The unpredicted, that's not what stops us from exploring. Sometimes when you crawl into a dark space, it's not what you think it's going to turn out to be. Other times, you can discover the things that are amazing and unique. So the curious amongst us will always find a justification for that curiosity. The meager go and stand in the shadows and complain and try and undermine what's happening. The interesting thing, though, nothing ever changes energy. Nothing. The energy is there. The spontaneity is there. The reason to try. You know, when people say, why not? What have we got to lose? You want to live a better life? What do you got to lose by trying Freemasonry? Except you give up, to have to examine your own and re-examine your own conscience and then admit to your sense of conceits. And that one is what connects us. When you talk like that, you begin to realize everybody has these notions. It's not unique to any one person. So that ability to justify a quarrel, an argument, a fight, a battle, to conjure up monsters where none exist. Well, I'm telling you, the risk is us. And the danger is us. If we let this kind of thoughtlessness get out of control, we do collectively great, great harm. And so calmer heads prevail. We sit back and that's where you wonder the role of the philosopher, the role of the moralist, that sense of morality inside each one of us. Well, make that protect that. Don't give it away. Here the show today is about vision and prism, huh? So think about that. I thought this was interesting. If you're talking about, you know, we get to play with notions of light, and we accept theoretically that it's a particle and it's a wave. So, you know, we're not. This is not to say that all of this is new. Thinkers were coming up with these ideas of molecular function and atomic function centuries ago, 1,000 years ago. Yeah, he's getting around there. And that information wasn't really either accepted or understood, so it languished. Today we're rediscovering and proving. We have to now, we're in that period of positivism, and we have to have a proof. So if somebody says something theoretical, we try very hard to prove it. In the meantime, if the best that we have is theory, then that's what we go with. We go with the theory that makes the most sense. A little rule of thumb, if something just seems highly unlikely, it probably is. So you can fool around on the edges of probability, and it gives you, it may make you feel clairvoyant. It doesn't mean necessarily that something unique and innovative is wrong-minded, but generally. Can you imagine Freemasons queuing to put a question to the Delphi Oracle? Yeah, I had a great time writing this and thinking about this. You know, we would ponder each in our own way. Let me ask one and have all of us ponder together. What is the epitome of Freemasonry? I use that word because I wasn't sure what's the heart, what's the point. So I put in the epitome. You put in your own word. We Masons have interesting tendencies. We avoid questioning what we do not understand. Doing that keeps us in darkness. Truth be known. We may be observant, but we have difficulty admitting what we don't know. Ah, a human trait, huh? Not knowing what we don't know. Of course, discussion in groups makes this safer. Our kind of discussion in groups brings these points out. So once we can identify them, then we can do something about it. That's the benefit of the fraternity. Always has been. It's wonderful. Notes and spaces. The note gives a value. The space in between those notes harmonizes them into phrases. And ignoring this balance is quite unpleasant. You know, the notes that don't come together in the chord doesn't sound pleasant to the ear. And we know notes, music, is mathematics. It's full of mathematical principles. Precision. Purity. Beautiful. The perfect Masonic structure thrives on resolution of discordance with balance. So once we resolve what it is that's taking away from balance, is that what the perfect Masonic structure is? Is that the fuel, the process of resolving discordance? I wondered, because I see that in lodges and districts, and I think, well, this is pretty commonplace, you know, there's disagreement, there's discussions going on, there's people that are persuasive, there's people that are just, you know, really having a weak positions. And we see that around the craft, and I began to think, this isn't anything new. This is always the way that it's been when you put men together. And it's not that that we're a quarrelsome lot. This process of debate and disagreement, it allows us to resolve problems. And allows us, and it is tedious. We like to have the efficiency of sort of these paramilitary operations. Somebody tell you what to do, and you just do it. What's wrong? Because if we don't, we start discussing everything, we can't do anything. Well, this is an organization that walks to a different drummer. This is an organization of understanding. Our goal is achieving enlightenment, and the process of learning that goes along doesn't happen in a uniform way. We're not in lockstep. But we know this isn't like giving a chimpanzee a typewriter and letting it bang away and then hoping it will come up with a great epic. It's not like that. You know, when was that cited? Back in the 40s? Yeah, something like that. You know, it isn't that randomness. No. This is a process, back and forth, a process of that's frustrating. So how do you avoid the frustrations? By finding points of convergence. But the only way we find that is by looking for it. And as we've often said on Masonic Companion, if you look for the Mason in the man, you will find him. If you look for the Masonic principle, if you don't, you'll find the conflict like anybody else. You'll exercise the predominant thinking of a man, not a Freemason. That's process, and nothing comes easy. Of course not. This is the work that we do, that frustration and that process of change. And while we're doing it, we do it in a chamber where the light around us is reflected. We're doing this where we realize that the light can be broken into different streams, different colors, that rainbow. And and then through the other side, all of those different processes, those different colors, different wavelengths converge into light. And there's no color to it, is there? It is important then to keep balance in mind because it is the right thing to do. Not that I said it is, it's the right thing to do. It is essential to elect and support the brightest and best when so much depends on it. After 157 years, of course the order has changed. Relevant even today because it has adapted. If we were in rigid lockstep, if nothing moved and nothing changed, we would be an anachronism. But today, Freemasonry is vital. It has an appeal, undergoing. It's morphing. It's progressing. With age comes awareness, explaining why our members are dutifully wanting to enhance the quality of the Masonic experience. We had been eager builders, and we were very good at it. We built lodges in small communities all across Upper Canada. And then you think about, you just close your eyes for a moment and think about it. This was a land that was forest. But you don't have vistas. You don't see 10 miles away. Your horizon is blocked. Not by, you know, by pine, 100-foot pine, 100 feet. Now, the trees that we generally see around us are, what, about 40 feet high? So think about a forest that's twice and more that height. And the coolness that you would feel inside the forest in the middle of the summer. And the protection of the forest in the winter. Well, you would start, we couldn't push a plow through that. It was very dense. So we started to clear the land for farming. And we cleared roads so that we could trade our goods, that we could bring in goods that we needed. Now, even our neighbors wouldn't be next door, so it became important to be able to share our labor. If somebody was in a jam, there was a mutual benefit in being able to do that. Early forms of insurance, you know? And of course, men who worked the land were able to recognize that, of course. But also that contact with each other was so welcome for so many reasons. And part of that was self-serving, but it was made cordial. It was made cordial. It wasn't done in a meager, demanding, grinding type of way. It was made entertaining and fun. Pleasant, yeah? Yeah. So we had then the task of setting up lodges in towns, and of course we emphasized the visit. Come and see. The curiosity is, you know, we're doing things in our community in a parochial way, but let's take a look at how other people are doing it, just to check it out. Now, back in the day, when we were checking out all these different variations on the theme, it became very apparent that our lodges, our organization, our form of Freemasonry was vulnerable, and it needed strong structure to protect us, to protect the things that we needed, the landmarks. And so our Grand Lodge grew and began to put into place constitutional statements that protected us inside. It may be, and of course, to understand all of them and the connections, this is really quite an interesting connection, one piece to another. This isn't linear. It's not like I can flip to a page in the book, find the answer to my question. This is where our Constitution requires thought and experience, where you pull it together. As our good friend Robert was telling me the other day, it was over in Toronto, you know, the different ways that a master of a lodge can handle complications that occur in a ballot. What can he do? Well, he can take a new ballot, repeat the ballot. He can suspend the balloting, and he can close the lodge immediately. And you know all that? You know the sound that would lead to that, huh? Yeah. There you go. So there is, but that requires a person that's knowledgeable to be able to know what options that he has to work with. When we look at our Constitution, it's there and it protects us and it does a very more than adequate job at that. And you know that it is constantly being reviewed. You and I can put forward a petition to change a part of the Constitution, yeah, and it will be debated and taken seriously. And if it is inconsistent with different elements of the Constitution, it will be struck down. Okay, but it is what it is. We do have Masonic laws that we respect a great deal, and we have people that are protecting our interests exercising those laws. With age comes awareness, and that explains, you know, we're now wanting a quality experience. We don't want to plunge it off the end of the dock into the icy cold water to prove our manhood. We may want to be able to see, to have beautiful sights around us. We want to be able to have good food around us, good companionship. We want to have good music. We want our ritual to be pleasant, not strained, not rigid, not demanding. We don't want the conflict in the room. We don't want the harshness. We want the leadership. We don't want somebody criticized in order to get the job done. That kind of bullying has no place around us. So we're looking for the quality. Maybe it's time we gave up the church basement mentality, that we put together comfortable rooms where men can sit and talk and share a drink. Believe it, a vital process of Freemasonry draws a man into an atmosphere of introspection, being alone in a crowd. This is the task of a mystery school. And after we support one another over a drink with a laugh and camaraderie. So it's not like you linger. You're not isolated. You have that moment of atmosphere of introspection supported by your fraternal sense. Many initiates come with expectations of exploration and mystery. To assist them, they need scholars and mentors to bring a welcoming sense of encouragement and guidance. Learning is an intimate process of the mind. Harmonics of note to space. Yeah? It comes together and it makes sense. So we have to drag the people off these poor new Freemasons, especially the people that think talking at a person is the way you educate. Or making a person feel guilty is a way to motivate them. Blah, blah, blah. Of course, this audience isn't like that. This audience, on this 39th day of the year, 2014, is enlightened. This audience, I hope. We are still striving to achieve some of our common goals. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot to learn. It's not a competition. Freemasonry is not a competition. Go and do that on the slopes. Sochi's full of that. Go ahead and have fun with that. You want to compete? It's not a competition. Who knows more? Do you understand anything about what you've read or done? What does it say to you? It doesn't mean because we read something that the meaning of it affects us. It doesn't. Sometimes, especially with some ideas of Freemasonry, you have to give a man an opportunity to work through it. To work through it. And the way his perspective, he may be looking at this through a different aspect of the prism than you. You don't know. Easy to assume and be mistaken. His way of approaching it may be very timid. He may think that it's very, very difficult, and he'd be right. So he may need a bit of encouragement, not to be discouraged. You don't do that mocking somebody and mocking or belittling the process. That is insensitive. And there's nothing Masonic about that. If anything, if Freemasonry is effective, the confidence comes from awareness. Not from past experience, not from the ability to be able to give orders in a different context. None of that matters. Not inside a lodge hall. Not a bit. Who would ever say that? Somebody that understands that the words, I shook my Masonic library and certain words fell out of the books. And the most surprising part of it what fell out of all of this knowledge wasn't notions of compliance and subordination. It was notions of respect and understanding and humility and a sense of charity that went beyond currency, a sense of charity of spirit. Who knew? Now, I may, and likely will, add another book of knowledge to the library, and what words will follow to that once I shake through it? Well, if you're shaken through your own library, share with us. Tell me. Send a note. MasonicCompanion@gmail.com. Tell me what words have fallen out of your material so far. Journey? I don't know if it's a real journey. think it's more a process. It's because I don't think the journey seems to say, well, there was a Big Bang and before that you didn't exist. Well, you know, we did. We all have history, different history. So it gives it a little bit of something to think about, a little bit, you know, you don't have to. My goodness, nobody's going to make you. You're not the worse off if you do or don't. But chairman of the lodge committee, by tradition, happens to be the senior warden in my lodge, was hospitalized and unable to attend the committee meeting. In the morning, he was pleased to receive a get-well message from the secretary, which read, "The committee took a decision to express their sincere good wishes for a speedy and complete recovery. 6 in favor, 3 against, 1 abstention." British, eh? British, yeah. To get that, yeah. Put it to the vote. Yeah, I can't. Have you heard of the lodge that was holding its meetings in the ballroom of a local hotel while its building was undergoing renovations? Good idea. One night, a traveling salesman asked the desk clerk who all these men were going into the room. And the clerk said, "Oh, those are Masons." The salesman said, "I've always wanted to join that lodge. Do you think they'd let me in?" Oh no, said the clerk. "They're awful exclusive. Why, you see that guy standing outside the door with his sword? He's been knocking for 6 months and they still won't let him in." Now that's a good, you got a bit. That's a good one. It's funny the things we do, eh? I'm going to take a little interlude here. There's, take a deep breath. I'm always thinking that sort of refreshes. What a deep breath here. I'm going to introduce some the works of some, you know, I've been introducing the idea of music and back into what I do, is at least sort of not just talking it, I'm actually doing it. And what better than to work with composers who were Freemasons? Yeah. So do you mind? I'm going to just put in a little bit of a break here for all of us. And this is a material from 2 Masons that you may, if you're fans of musicals, you'll know this. And if you're not, you would like to become more knowledgeable about musical theater. This is quite famous. It's a operetta, light singing. And this is from Gilbert and Sullivan. And both those boys were of the craft. Yeah. So I've picked a piece that's called the Sorcerer. Yeah. And this is a little piece that I think you'll like this. I think it's a bit of fun. Check it out. And this is it. Masonic music, I guess. Music by Masons.
But soft, they waken one by one. The spell has worked, the deed is done. I would suggest that we retire while love the housemaid lights her kitchen fire. While love the housemaid lights her kitchen fire.
Like white mist.
For I tell you true, which I never done, sir.
Aha! Like that? A little piece. Usually we would turn to the Mikado, which is sort of, these things are a bit sort of overstated, so they're always a little bit silly, frivolous, but well staged and well costumed. So that's from Gilbert and Sullivan. We'll come back to that in another show. The idea of the talents of Freemasons that we can share and give us all some shared pleasure. I'm sitting here with a copy of a book that I recommend you try and find. I noticed that mine, it's called The Pocket History of Freemasonry, and it's by Fred L. Pick and G. Norman Knight, with a K. And these are notable Masons, don't make any mistake, as in the past master of Quattro Coronati Lodge 2076, you know, the research lodge of Manchester Lodge of Masonic Research, yep. And both of them. So, and it's from the Philosophical Library. Of course, this is well out of print. The copy that I have was copyrighted in 1953. So you can search around. This one cost $1.98. Little tiny book. But it gives a really interesting, it's quick, it's sort of a bedstand reader. The Origin of Freemasonry, Medieval Operative Freemasonry, Old Charges. I'll get into a little bit of that today. Even the Holy Royal Arch and the Mark and Royal Arch Freemasonry, Additional Degrees, Freemasonry and the Forces, History of Scottish Freemasonry, Irish Freemasonry. So a nice little compendium, and it's a very proper little book. Even it talks, you know, it hits the, doesn't waste any time. There's not a lot of fill-in between the words. And even like the progress of the ancients, you know, that wonderful, interesting period of ancients and moderns that gave rise to some of the things that we use even today, that blend of ancients and moderns, and trying to understand it. And understand the conflict, understand the disagreement, understand the resolution. So I'll get into No Old Charges and Mother Kill Winning Lodge in a little bit of a minute. But we've been talking about, we'll bring up, this isn't the week to get into the tarot and the connection between Freemasonry and tarot card, you know, the divination. Too much alchemy in the room for you. And we're not going to get into, we're going to try and keep to a bit of an agenda. This, again, I'm going to pick up on that work by James Stevens Curl in his really interesting period. We've been reading about and going over material about the Renaissance period of Freemasonry. For those who like to think, try and track our route, remember, 1717 is coming up, where we'll all have that, and I'm looking forward to the celebrations. I'm certainly hoping that there will be within our Grand Lodge. And a little tip of the hat to the Grand Lodge of England. Eh? United Grand Lodge of England wasn't that at the start, but not to be unkind, but as we go on, I'll start to talk about the different names and different periods and the evolution of that Grand Lodge. And you know, the United Grand Lodge, what that meant, what was uniting. But 300 years, it means something. 300 years is an awful long time. And we're no longer that type of man. We're far, far more sophisticated, truly. More going on. We have progressed, and we live longer. And I'll say it for all of us, and we live better. That's exactly what they would have hoped for us. That's exactly what they were aiming for. So 300 years from now, I hope our brethren are living better and enjoying more life than we are today. And in my own way, I'll try and make that happen. And if they're going through the material of a Masonic Companion 300 years hence, I'd like to think that it has a bit of resonance, that they can connect with all of us and get into the thinking, the stuff that historians are plumbing for us, the thinking of the people at the time, what influences occurred that brought their decisions to the forefront. Why did they live the way that they did? And, of course, in historical hindsight, why did they not recognize these big caveats, these big problems, these gaps, problems? And when they came up, how did they resolve them? So here's a chewy piece of history. Fill your glass, top it up with whatever libation is suitable for your circumstance where you are as you listen to this. This is about, I'm going to talk to you about the Hermetic tradition. Yeah. This is a meal savored gradually. Mm. So, I see you all standing in your with your leather aprons on, leaning over your work tables with some candles guttering out beside you, and others giving off the soot and light that you need to continue your work. You're in the alchemist's laboratory, searching for truths. And here in the background is somebody talking to you about the Hermetic tradition. The Renaissance Hermetic tradition appears to have developed through Marsilio Ficino from 1433 to 1499 and Pico della Mirandola from 1463 to 1494, and gained a new lease of life in the 17th century. Yeah. Robert Flood was an adherent of the 17th century. Remember, the civil war is going on in Britain. Yeah. Robert Flood, with a U and two D's, was an adherent of the philosophy of the Egyptian priest Hermes Trismegistus, identified with Euclid, Thoth, and others. And as is apparent in his Tractatus Apologeticus, blah, 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 blah. I won't even begin. Apologetia Compendiata Fratrentum de Rosia Curtia Suspicionatus Infamia Apersam Veritatis Quasi Flutipis Abluens and Astorgans. Well, it was worth a try. Flood's work set out the basic scheme developed by Pico della Mirandola when he added the Kabbalah to the revival of Hermetic philosophy, encouraged by Ficino's interpretation of the recovered Hermetic texts. Giordano Bruno and Michael Mayer are also figure prominently in what Dr. Yates has called the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. Mayer was the author of Arcana Acarnasima Hocest Hieroglyphica et Chapito Graeca, and was himself close to the court of the Emperor Rudolf II, who appears to have been devoted to alchemy and magic. So he was just like you and me. The title page of Arcana Acarnasima featured two obelisks, each set on four balls on pedestals, with figures of Osiris, Isis, and Typhon, Ibis, and Apis Bull, and Cynocephalus, and a Cynocephalus, C-Y-N-O-cephalus. Maybe while you're listening to this, you can pull that one up, eh? Mayer's Symbola Araya Mens Ducrem Nashirum is a volume not entirely innocent of Egyptian or Egyptianizing ideas, and it contains material of Hermetus Egyptorium Regis in Symbolium. Both Mayer and Flood were published in Oppenheim, and both had connections with England, the Netherlands, the court of the Elector Palatine, and the court of the Emperor himself. Mer, like Flood and Dee, did much to promote Egyptian Hermetic truth. His Symbola enthuses over the wisdom of Hermes and celebrates the sacredness of the Virgin Queen Chemia, who is obviously Isis, the font of wisdom. The Virgin Queen is also found in Elizabethan times, even to the extent of having an approved icon, and is yet another instance of a universally loved medieval Catholic image leaving a void that had to be filled by beleaguered Protestantism, Isis returning in another guise. So, what was old is new again. Good idea, just revamped. Love those early Christians. But we're really talking about variations on the theme with the Protestantism. The product of the work of 15th century work of Luther. Yeah. I was fed up with this opulence, saying this isn't the way the church is, you know, you're not, the church shouldn't be dripping honey and swaggering with rank. It's not the notion of, it's not helping the common people. Boy, did he make a point, hey? Eh? Even reached to Constantinople. And, today, it's an uncanny little, take this sideways for a second, we've got somebody running around the Vatican doing some very, very interesting, Masonically interesting things. This is a guy that's got some very interesting things on the go, and I can't imagine the amount of, you know, he is stepping, he's coloring outside the lines in that faith. Whoa. Interesting dude. Interesting guy. Let's see what he can do with the world. He's got the attention of a lot of people. Throughout, study reference will be made to the significance of Protestantism, Hermeticism, symbolism, and secretism with reference to Freemasonry. There is at least one extraordinary artifact that links Scotland, emblems, labyrinths, Masonic symbolism, and Reformation, and an ill-fated bid to establish a Protestant kingdom in Bohemia, in the heart of the Holy Roman Empire itself. The Winter King and Queen established a garden in Heidelberg that, to Protestant Renaissance minds, was the eighth wonder of the world. Salomon de Cocq's architect laid out one of the most interesting and well-documented of all Renaissance gardens for Frederick V, Elector Palatinate, and son-in-law of King James I and VI at Heidelberg. De Cocq's designs were published in Hortus Palatinus by J.T. de Brie in Frankfurt in 1620, which included a panorama by Marian showing English knot gardens, K-N-O-T, borderies or embroidered gardens, fountains, grottos, and a labyrinth of cliptegias. The complex iconography, the program involving a belief in a universal harmony, and the Euclidean, Platonic, and Pythagorean systems of numbers have been adequately discussed elsewhere. That was a bit scary for a second, eh? According to this interpretation, the soul moves through various states represented by parts of the garden, through the maze representing the confusion of life's journey, to the new harmony of the orange parterre, where even nature is changed and understood by the intellect, and on to a new plane of revelation through astrology and the mysteries of divine love. Such a program, of course, suggests the Reformation and a proto-enlightenment based on Hermetic philosophies that have been embraced by Giordano Bruno and Pico della Mirandola, who, recognizing that Christianity was anything but unique and that there was much in Roman Catholicism that owed more to of a debt to classical antiquity than diehard reactionaries would care to admit. The gardens of Heidelberg evoked marvels by such means as mechanical fountains that emitted musical sounds and were suggested by the rediscovery of ancient texts. some of which had come from Alexandria. Solomon de Caus employed systems of design in which architecture, hydraulic engineering, perspective, geometry, ideals of proportion based on the meaning of numbers, and mathematical science were used. There were grottos, fountains, statues, and many other devices that would have conjured up the ancient world, but most importantly, the use of a numerical study in order to create mechanical musical instruments heralds the obsessions of the Enlightenment with gadgets, as well as evoking antique ideas and pointing the way to industrial power in the centuries ahead. De Caus seems to have employed steam power for some of these machines, which he based on Vitruvian and Pythagorean precedents, and which looked forward to the mammoth organs and water displays of 19th century Europe and America. The Hortus Planetus was a symbol of a proto-enlightenment that embraced universal systems of harmony and proportion. It was a series of experiences that through which one could pass and reflect and had its parallels, though not its exact antecedents or derivatives, in ancient and later gardens. It was to be destroyed by the same forces of reaction that condemned Bruno to the stake and that stemmed the tide of inquiry in Protestant Europe. Danger, huh? If the design of the garden is startling in the context of this study, the title page of Hortus Palatinus was even odder. It was a massive, blocky, primitivist, almost neoclassical architrave that, with bold crossettes and plain oversailing cornice, framed the lettering. On the cornice, a putto dangled a square set, compasses, and other implements of architecture and building, while holding in his left hand a lighted torch for illumination, exposition, and truth. Two putti in the center carried a cathedral form composed of five stars, and another putto on the right dangled a mirror and other attributes. At the base, Minerva faced Hermes with caduceus and dividers, while between the two seated figures were a pyramid, a cube, various polyhedral forms. It might well have been a Masonic frontispiece. Giordano Bruno made use of Hermetic themes. He preached a reformation of the world based on a return to Egyptian wisdom and religion, as revealed in Hermetic treatises. Religious differences were to be overcome through love and magic, and Bruno's ideas were carried through Northern Europe to become enshrined in the Rosicrucian movement. Bruno was to die at the stake for his conviction that the wisdom of ancient Egypt was greater than that displayed by a repressive orthodoxy that burned dissidents. His denial of the unique nature of Christianity included the observation that even the cross with halo was a symbol invented by the Egyptians, the Ankh. And he clearly saw the debt that Christian belief and practice owed to the ancient cults of Isis and Osiris, including the virgin birth, and to restore sight. Even the attributes of the Blessed Virgin Mary were the same as those of Isis, Stella Maris, protectress in death, and queen of heaven, but are but three examples. Bruno must have smiled a wryly cynical smile when considering that the Inquisition demanding his life ignored the fact that the Vicar of Christ had claimed descent from Osiris through the dubious researches of Aeneas of Viterbo, and that the Apis bull and the other Egyptian deities and figures decorated not only the missal of Cardinal Pompeo Colonna, but the Borgia apartments themselves in the Vatican. Wry smile, but not very helpful when they're trying to condemn a man. The religion of the Egyptians was held to contain prophecies of Christianity and seen as the imperfect harbinger, so modern scholarship tends to vindicate Bruno and others. The Hermetic writings were, in fact, later than Christ, although this is not known in late medieval or Christian times. But the ideas in Hermeticism concerned with the spiritual journey and the search of the individual found favor in Protestant circles. Renaissance minds looked back to antiquity with admiration, and the search for ancient wisdom was paralleled by the search for the art and architecture of the ancients. The purified religion of the Reformation sought inspiration from the examples of the early Christians and from the texts of antiquity in which wisdom of a spiritual nature was enshrined. Religious strife, persecution, bloody war between Protestant and Counter-Reformation forces, and fragmentation among the Protestant ranks led to a growing tendency toward private contemplation and secret observance. It seems that apparent conformity with whatever was regarded as orthodox was disguised devotion to hermetic ideas that were felt to be older, nobler, purer, and truer than the warring factions of Christianity. Bruno did not keep his hermeticism secret, but argued for a sort of Egyptian Reformation mixed with ideas of good works and utilitarianism for the benefit of mankind. He also deplored the passing of many of the best features of medieval organization, including the charitable and social cohesion given by the old guilds. Dr. Yates, in her Giordano Bruno, wondered where there was a combination of religious tolerance, emotional linkage with the past, emphasis on good works for others, and imaginative attachments to the religion and symbolism of the Egyptians. The answer she came up with in her studies was Freemasonry, for hermetic ideas in Freemasonry have points of closeness that cannot be dismissed. Freemasonry emerged with lodges, minute books, records, some sort of national organization, non-operative members, the development of ethical ideas and symbols, references to the Mason word, catechisms and ceremonies, degrees or grades, entered apprentice, fellow craft, and the master in Scotland by 1600, as David Stevenson has shown. And it would be very curious if hermetic influence so widespread through Europe were not injected into Freemasonry. As Dr. Stevenson has pointed out, the period saw the peak of the hermetic striving for enlightenment and the spiritual rebirth of mankind based on secret knowledge and secret societies or cults. When a system of lodges emerges in Scotland with secret rituals and identification signs, just as the great esoteric hermetic movement was sweeping across Europe, there surely must have been a link between them. Quite so. There must indeed be a link, and the strong Egyptian flavor and much Masonic design must stem from this and from the idea that obscure hieroglyphical inscriptions held sacred truths. Yet we have seen that much Aseic illusion was actually preserved in the church as part of the Marian cultus, and that other ideas, such as the connections with Daedalus and the labyrinth, were openly displayed by medieval Masons in cathedral floors, such as those at Chartres and Reims. Is there, therefore, some possibility of truth in the Masonic claim that much ancient lore was actually passed over through the lodges themselves from antiquity? This idea may not be so far-fetched as has been suggested by some hitherto, although there must have been a new injection of Hermeticism during the Renaissance period, which gave new life to old customs. So help me here, gentlemen. And ladies, there's Lady Masons amongst you. And what we're being told here is that it's a reasonable assumption, and I put that to you, that lodges themselves became a portal of ancient information, Hermeticism, and the connection with Egyptian religion that predated Christianity. And as Bruno made so public, that Christianity was not unique, completely unique, but it had brought forward really excellent ideas, I'll say excellent ideas, brilliant ideas from the past. And the more he studied, he was saying, well, this isn't unique to Christianity. This was borrowed from, this was going on 1,000 years earlier, in 2,000 years earlier in Egypt. So here, this thesis suggests that it was Masonic lodges, the lodge halls, where those ideas were being discussed that brought them forward, particularly up to the Renaissance period. My own view is that something did survive, according to the researcher Stevenson, and that it was reinterpreted and revived from the 16th century, but that the survivals were overlaid, obscured, and corrupted. Yeah, word of mouth would have done that. You tell me the secret, you tell me the information, and then I had passed it on verbally, or so that oral history makes it very, very difficult because I'm working it through my mind, my history, my experiences, and trying to portray the same meaning that you gave to me, and then on and on and on. We teach our children that game, don't we, where we pass on a single word or a message and go in a circle and find what what has changed with the last telling. Yet the Daedalus Labyrinth connection with antiquity is irrefutable, as is God as architect, Imhotep Phat, P-T-A-H, that's how it's spelled, Imhotep, God as architect, and Isis transformed as Mary. So the Egyptian theme was there all the time. Masonic legends, as encapsulated within the old charges, include allusions to Hermes, the preserver of knowledge, who not only treasured the wisdom and methods of the craft, but in due course passed that heritage on to mankind after the flood. This is antediluvian, isn't it? It's diluvian. Yeah. So, the preserver of knowledge. Here again, syncretism, that's S-Y-N, syncretism, plays a familiar role, its familiar role, for Euclid is supposed to have instructed the male offspring of the Egyptian aristocracy in the mysteries of the craft. And there is much else that points to an Egyptian or Greco-Egyptian set of legends, many of which overlap, interlock, and merge with each other. In 1600, therefore, Freemasonry would have been accepted as part of a great Hermetic movement in a time of striving, change, and intellectual ferment. It is not fanciful to identify Hermes Trismegistus as a kind of patron of Freemasonry, for by that curious process of syncretism and overlaying, Hermes, messenger of the deities, could also be associated with Christian saints, and who could be regarded as more perfect for such a role than St. John the Baptist, as the great messenger of Christ himself. Matters do not rest even there. It is recognized that many Christian saints took over attributes from pagan deities. The myriad Madonnas of southern Europe have their forerunners in the Protean Isis and the greatness of all goddesses, with her crescent moon, her horns, her stars, her fountains, her roses, her connection with the sacred unit of measurement, the cubit. It must be of great significance that both St. John the Baptist and St. John the Evangelist were venerated as patron saints of the Mason craft. Indeed, the companions of the Royal Arch, in what is known as Brown's Ritual, toast the pious memory of the two St. Johns, those two great parallels in Freemasonry. We follow their precepts and profit by their example. So Hermes, Trismegistus, Mercury, and John Baptist and Evangelist were probably also St. John of Jerusalem, who is also known as St. John the Almoner in that, by now, familiar syncretic process mixed. The attributes of St. John the Baptist and St. John the Evangelist include the camel hair coat, rough cross, lamb, open book, dragon or serpent emerging from a chalice, and a young man with an eagle and occur in some Masonic designs. Veneration of one St. John or another was not confined to the Mason crafts alone. Many guilds or mysteries favored the St. John, and in Wagner's Der Mistreiger von Nürnberg, Veit Pogner sings, of the Schoenfest Johannistag, indicating that St. John the Baptist was significant in the medieval guilds of Nuremberg as well. And this seems to have been true of many fraternities of the Middle Ages. The Johannistag was at midsummer, so it is the Baptist Nativity which was celebrated, and Hermes was the proto-John. There. That's a very rich meal. Let's leave that. Let's think about that for a moment. That's suggesting what the people who have studied the institutions, religious institutions, have realized. We go back in time, we discover things that we know were brought forward. And we know most of the dates for religious holidays are old, old pagan dates. We even know that the term pagan, Kate, was a term that was not in use until the organized churches wanted to delineate their turf, in a way. Remember that proselytizing was purposeful to take over the entire world. I can imagine the conflict that created. We're from another land, and we come in, and we're going to tell these people that what they've been doing is completely wrong, and that we'll kill them if they don't adapt to our way of thinking. How sad. And we see through history that these great nations and cultures pushed back. They had to. We would. So we'll come up next to... So we see a strong argument put forward here by these scholars that the Hermeticism is infused not only in the Rosicrucian studies, but also in the Royal Arch studies, and basic to the beliefs and iconography of ancient and accepted Freemasonry. Only we're now making a connection. It's not to say it's between Egypt, ancient Egypt, and Freemasonry. When you think about parliamentary function, do you think about 5th century Greece? No, of course you don't. But you know that what we see going on in Parliament that we find so distasteful, that bickering and the lack of respect, this was and is history repeating itself. The original democracy that everything else is built on, modified, was like that. It was chaos. Who was there to tell you not to speak your mind? And so you had to become aggressive in order to be persuasive, in order to be heard. So you and I would sit down in the agora, and this is where we would be educated. And this is how we would be educated. And then walks into that every day, an unassuming guy who did his national duty when he was called up, walked around barefoot, had cheap clothes, a thin robe around him, a paunch, wasn't particularly attractive, but he's exceptionally bright. And he was curious. He was a man of conscience that wanted all of mankind to benefit from the examination of it and development of insight. A pure humanist. He gave his life for it, eh? Yeah. Can I get into... I want to come back next week. We'll come back to some things more, a little more functional. We're going to talk to you about mnemonic techniques in Freemasonry, okay? What that means. It's helpful. You may have to go over and do a more work around the topic that we had today about Hermetism and the Cabal. We'll probably tackle that. That's not a dish you want to mix with the talk of Hermeticism. That's a standalone meal. That's like going to from a steakhouse. You know, if you go to where you're overwhelmed with the size of it, to a place where you're finding a well-aged cut served in maybe a nice sauce. So we want to keep those meals separated. Sometimes we want French. Sometimes we want Italian. Sometimes we want Canadian type of cuisine. Yeah, so Hermeticism, we've been sitting down to a meal of Egyptian idea. And we see a reassessment of the function of a Masonic lodge. So there you have it. We weren't just dormant. It wasn't just sitting there doing nothing. The lodges did have a purpose. So, and still do. What messages are we conveying today? Well, in some places, the discussions are lively and historical because they're important. We have this, our halls are still windows. We may not be using them. We may not be connecting with the past, but that doesn't mean the window is closing around us. It's opportunity. We're not using it. Part of that, I think, is that we can't all have Socrates walking into our lodges asking, you know, to be initiated. That's the spread. That's the complication when we have so many different halls. Well, that's not to say that they don't have a merit. Of course not. Let's be respectful after all. But it's also to say, if Socrates is over in that lodge, then I might be inclined to go over and listen to him. And I might be foolish to ignore the opportunity. So to the Socrates out there amongst you, I hope you're picking up where where we're leaving off here. I'm going to just, I don't know if John Coltrane was a member of Kraft. I'm just going to give us a little bit of, some jazz that might draw some ideas up to your to mind. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about we'll get into a little bit about Johnson's Masonry Defined, that work of that volume about the questions and answers, Masonic Education as a material, a book of questions and answers. Just fascinating stuff. And if we get back into, you know, the history of Grand Lodge, we've got a nice book here by Harrington that we can get into. But before that, I think we'll get into Living the Enlightenment. Yeah, I think I owe you that. This is a little John Coltrane, of course. And thank you. Speaks to you, doesn't it? If you let it, yeah. We'd started last week with material from Margaret Jacob, "Living the Enlightenment: Freemasonry and the Politics and Politics in 18th Century Europe." And remember, we were talking about creating constitutional societies, and she let us. Led us into a bit of the history, brought in the history of the Dutch Republic and the development of Dutch Masonic lodges. And I would think that she did that partly because there was such a rich amount of detail available. The people were careful scribes. And so we were able to access through her work how constitutional societies did begin to develop outside of a government. Quite significant. So the ability to work constitutionally was no longer under the lone control of government. And in fact, we have a Grand Lodge Constitution, but we also have systems of bylaws that are tailored by lodges. So here I want to remind you, bring you back, let's go back into history a little bit, into 1755, okay? Pre a lot of things. 1755, Rousset's Lodge saw itself. Remember Rousset. This is the background for the reconstitution of Le Bien Ami in 1755 and the political thought woven into its history. That year, its leading spokesman was a publisher and friend, Johann Schroeder. He's a friend of Rousset. So this is, we're going back to the exile. Remember, Rousset was exiled in 1749 for holding some, what would you say, libertine ideas? Yeah. In 1755, Rousset's Lodge saw itself as persecuted by the larger society by a slanderous public, evil-minded hypocrites, quoting here, prejudiced writers, frightened rulers, cursed Inquisition, thundering Vaticans, and booming preachers. In the history of our days, as Johann Schroeder lectured to his brothers on the annual feast day in late 1755, could be added the, quote, blackened reputations of the Vatican and the Inquisition, the names of the cities of Amsterdam and Nijmegen. In the past few years since its closing, he continued, the lodge has been like a hunted bird. Our only joy comes from the contemplation of ourselves. Only recently, he continued, the brothers had been like sheep without a shepherd. But now, after receiving proper and legal authority, we joyfully reopened our lodge as legal members of a legal lodge. Schroeder's obsessive concern is to assert the legal, in his use of his own words, existence of the reconstituted lodge and to affirm its legality by pointing to the growth in membership, and more important, to the fact that other lodges recognize it. See, the idea of visit connection is legitimizing the function. You didn't know you did that, did you? Indeed, even Freemasons from other countries visit the lodge and sign its visitor's book. Legality and hence legitimization, he asserts, are provided by the representatives of other lodges. And these, in turn, receive a legal reception from Le Bien Ami. The law that Schroeder refers to here has nothing to do with the laws of the country. These are laws and legality being created in the private realm by men for other men, by the lodges themselves. Masonic law was taken most seriously by the brothers. In 1756, when the reconstituted lodge was quarreling with the Grand Lodge in The Hague over allegiance to it, what was at stake between them were what they described as legitimization and sovereignty. The rule of laws and the nature of duly constituted authority. In this instance, the legitimization of the lodge of this new civil society depends more upon its legality than upon its traditions, or upon the quality and birthright of its masters. By the 1760s, the Grand Lodge would extend its legal prerogatives nationally and assume the power to adjudicate between plaintiffs and defendants, even awarding damages to the defendant when he was absolved of the accusations against his person. The 1755 minutes of Le Bien Ami's meetings bear out the relevance of Schroeder's oration about legitimacy. In late 1754, members of the disbanded lodge met, consulted and deliberated with each other, and decided to request that the very vulnerable master, Brother Rousset de Missy, out of his power and authority, by an authentic document, would grant and authorize them to form a regular lodge, and would, for his part, appoint a brother in his name, and for this part to reopen the closed lodge, to form the brothers into a legal lodge. Schroeder wrote to Rousset, still exiled in a small town outside of Utrecht, and asked his permission to reopen the lodge. He responded with true joy. We approve thus the proposition that Schroeder has made for our part, and we consent very willingly to the request of our honorable brothers. And they named Pierre Brunel as the master of the lodge. But the legitimacy of the reconstituted lodge rested more than its probity. It depends on various factors. Rousset's permission and approval were seen as essential. He is still their master, and this passing on of legitimacy lies in his person, just as the care and protection of the English constitutions of 1723 are paternal. In the minutes of another lodge from exactly the same period, we can hear how this is played out. Personal, yet constitutional, understanding of authority was expressed. The master of the lodge presented his successor to his brother who had elected him with these words, "Receive then from my hands, by the consent of all our brother members, the signs of our new dignity. And my very dear brothers, receive your very vulnerable master. Have for him all the love and devotion that he merits. This election has been made possible by the faculty that we have been given by the Constitution. At this moment of presentation, the master is a figure as traditional as he is modern. Authority is being passed to him out of the hands of his predecessor. He has also been chosen by public suffrage, the vote, by the unanimous consent of the members. We may associate his legitimacy with theories of governance that are traditional and patriarchal, hereditary even, as well as they are modern, and in a Lockean sense, contractual and elective. Not least, the brothers are asked to accept the result of public vote to bear witness to it publicly in the lodge. At this moment, the private has become the public. In every lodge, and Le Bien Aimé is no exception, the brothers constituted the lodge for themselves, and they submitted willingly to the authority of the master, who was expected to govern with the care of a tender father. Thus, in Le Bien Aimé, the brothers requested the reestablishment of the lodge. And remember that. I'm overlooking that. The master is expected to govern with the care of a tender father. Once it was reestablished, they were dutifully attentive of Rousset's instructions, incorporating them into the elaborate set of household rules used to guide the behavior of all brothers. Yet within 2 years, the brothers, now over 50 strong, declared that they did not regard the old constitutions and rules of England as fixed and the unchanging basis of their work and behavior, but regard them as good helping aids to be used when necessary as a first point of deliberation, and then to use them as far as the character of business agrees with the constitution of the order in this country, as well as with the respective lodges in particular. This flexibility appears to have been a response to the increasingly national character of Freemasonry within the Republic. By contrast, however, and over the years, Rousset's lodge would tend to support the preservation of the English ritual and oppose departures from this ancient orthodoxy initiated by the Grand Lodge. It would also demand the right to enter into opposition and to protest if changes were too hurriedly adopted. So in 1756, the main and oldest lodge in The Hague had established itself as the National Grand Lodge. The terms national and the nation begin to appear routinely now in Masonic discussions. The establishment was an event of capital importance to its contemporary supporters. In Masonic documents, lodges that affiliated with the new national polity spoke of their great satisfaction at having been informed of the happy revolution that arrived at the end of the year 1756, when all the lodges of Holland assembled, having reestablished a very respectful Grand Lodge. Respectable. To describe this establishment as a happy reunion was to conjure up language both historical and political. English Whigs often referred to 1688-89 as the late happy revolution. Be careful about that word happy. That's a minefield, isn't it? We are reminded of the French expose that had the Masonic lodges in England being established in 1691 in direct response to that revolution. Could it be that the French Freemasons were attempting to create their national polity in self-conscious imitation of the spirit of that revolution? Is this a parliamentary and constitutional system being established in the new Masonic nation? As extraordinary as it may seem, the answer to these questions may be affirmative. The very next statement by the Lodge Philanthropie in the city of Middelburg, the capital of the southern province of Zeeland, provides the clue. Although welcoming the establishment of the Grand Lodge as a happy revolution, the Zeeland Lodge, composed of some of the most elite men in the city, noted that it had not participated at the founding. The reason for this reluctance sprang from its own sovereignty. The province of Zeeland has been separate from the others. And given the fact that this province made a sovereignty apart, the brothers who reside here in order to participate in the happy union of their neighboring brethren see the need to recognize and to unite themselves especially to the very respectable Grand Lodge, which came to be constituted in Holland, in order that their participation, by their participation, they render complete its spread over all the Republic. Fabulous. Fabulous. Thus, the recognition given by individual lodges to the Grand Lodge is hard won and sometimes grudgingly given. The rights of sovereignty had to be weighed against the need for social recognition on a national scale and legitimation. A major portion of the discussions in The Hague between Grand Lodge and the other lodges concerns their adherence to the authority of the National Grand Lodge and its rules. Where that authority was actually accepted, representatives of Grand Lodge made inspection visits to individual lodges, our district deputy grand masters. Le Bien Ami was, however, most noticeable among those lodges that obstinately resisted its authority. When the Grand Lodge could win the allegiance of a lodge, as it did in the case of the Middleburg Lodge, the reward was a new constitution along with the faculty to hold elections within the lodge. Adherence to the Masonic tradition brought with it legitimacy that was constitutionally established and expressed through open elections. The impulse to work at the formation of the National Grand Lodge was deeply idealistic. As one orator told his brothers in 1751, against human instinct, we should seek to unite, to unify with their hearts and souls in order to improve themselves, and in order to form an entirely spiritual union. That oration was a direct translation of a printed oration given in Paris in 1737 by a leading Masonic orator and eventual master, the Chevalier Ramsay. What is happening in the Dutch Republic among Freemasons of the 1750s will be repeated throughout Western Europe as national grand lodges are formed, as schisms erupt, as men and perhaps some women attempt to think through the meaning of living under their constitutions. The Zeeland Lodge's new allegiance to this spiritual nation did not obscure its recognition to the rights of the local and actual political authorities. The Seigneurie Estée de cette Provence. They had imposed a stamp tax on all official documents. The master of the lodge informed his brothers that the principal duties of Masonry consist in the obedience to its sovereign and in the exact observance of the law which conduces to the benefit of the whole society. The lodge then deliberated as to whether or not it should use the stamps for all of its documents. It agreed to thank the master unanimously and to show their zeal for the public good and their submission to their legitimate sovereigns, but not least to pay the tax. These Dutch Freemasons, like their European counterparts, were good burghers, drawn in this instance from the most elite ranks of the local society. Doctors, lawyers, military officers, merchants, government officials, a director of the East India Company are commonplace occupations given in the records of Middleburg Lodge. In their enlightened deliberations, to use the phrase that these and other Masonic records repeatedly used, they sought no undoing of the existing social and political order. They were too closely identified with it, yet faced with issues of sovereignty and legitimacy, they proved to be remarkably self-willed to discuss and to vote before giving their consent. On occasion, they could also withhold their consent, as did the Amsterdam Lodge, when faced with the claims to authority proposed by the Grand Lodge in The Hague. Operating with quite a different perspective on the obedience owed the new Grand Lodge and refusing to give it, Le Bien Ami struggled to impose order on its members, levying fines for violations, requiring the dues to be paid by all brothers, or in their words, they would be taxed. In the earliest records of the reconstituted lodge, the concern is more with legitimacy than with behavior, with distancing the lodge from clandestine lodges in the city that were without any legitimate standing. We know little about such groups, although one was a certain Jewish lodge in Amsterdam. To ensure its legitimacy and hence to separate itself from these lodges, Le Bien-Ami established contact with other Dutch lodges and with foreign lodges such as Minerva zum Zirkel in Leipzig, a contact made by Schroeder, who, as a publisher, journeyed frequently to that city. There he was received with all solemnity by his brethren and representatives as envoys from the Leipzig Lodge visited the lodge in Amsterdam. The Dutch brethren praised their German colleagues for the continual conquest of profanism, and they sent songs to augment the festivities at their enlightened assemblies. When, in turn, a German lodge found its legitimacy threatened by a clandestine lodge in the same city, the Amsterdam brothers offered to help. If you want our judgment, please send us copies of the acts on which you base your rights and legitimacy. The contacts of Le Bien-Ami routinely extended to sister lodges in Amsterdam and throughout Western Europe, such as in Stockholm, where it received a gold medal as a token of friendship. They also reached the Nantes, La Rochelle, and even the Dutch colonies, and in particular Curaçao. These merchant travelers, former members of the Amsterdam Lodge, their mother lodge as they put it, established their own lodge and promptly sought an ample and perfect constitution from the Grand Lodge in The Hague. Certain for constitutional legitimacy was not unique to Le Bien-Ami. In 1755, its sister lodge, Concordia Vincent Aminis, would not recognize another lodge in the city until it produced copies of its original constitutions from France. It also would not allow the physical removal from the lodge of its own constitution, and it insisted that at the elections of the National Grand Master in 1756, the papers of every lodge be scrutinized. So, does it help? I think the pertinence of this for us is really to answer the question, does it help to look at the context? I think it does, because I think it's easy for us to begin to think that the workings of our Grand Lodge and our function here in Upper Canada was somehow arbitrary or isolated. You can see the struggles and trying to present a sense of context on a broader geographic and historical scale. I think the Masonic Companion owes that to you. To put what's going on here into the context of Freemasonry and the function of lodges, relationship of lodges to Grand Lodges and other areas. So we begin to see it's a little safer, I think, to talk about somebody else in another place at another time and then extrapolate lessons like they would of us. Hopefully they'll take lessons that they can learn from our experience. When books are written about the experience here in Upper Canada and they're studied in other jurisdictions. So we get to see that the importance of a constitution had something to do with the protection from clandestine organizations. Clandestine does not mean benign, safe, wonderful, chatting halls. We're talking about challenge for authenticity and authority, aggression, politics. So you and I may take for granted a lot about our Grand Lodge, and I tend to think that we do. I know that I'm quite conservative about my respect for our Grand Lodge, but I think I'm trying to build the case in my own mind and the minds of a lot of people. And yes, I'm trying to persuade, I think, or illustrate that this respect that we can give to our Grand Lodge is well-deserved and serves a very important function for all of us. And it's ridiculous to think that when we are asked to provide support, that we would create arguments to avoid taking that next step and doing the right thing, quite frankly, rather than making suppositions. We need to ask for clarification. In this way, I don't think our Grand Lodge, I don't think we teach the form of Masonic charity that is contained in the ancient charges. We are, I think, sadly, collectively not very charitable with our Grand Lodge toward it. Where did that lesson go? Where in the world did it go? We are like Le Bien Ami, where we don't accept or reject that authority, and yet hanging on our wall, we exist through the authority of Grand Lodge, and we celebrate the representatives of Grand Lodge coming to scrutinize the work through the district deputies. Seems that our morality is a pick and choose. When we do that, I think we're creating a morality of convenience. We'll do what's convenient, and what's not convenient, we'll agree and support each other in that belief. I think that's a lodge that is uncomfortably at arm's length from adherence to willing adherence. We fall into line willingly. And when lodges will make that argument that they're being forced to do something, I think that reveals far more about the speaker than it does about the process. If you can think that way, that tells about you. Anyway, that's from Living the Enlightenment. An interesting bit of work. We'll get into that a bit more. We don't have a whole lot of time left together. Kind of thought we had some interesting things going on here. Huh? I don't want to talk about, I don't feel like talking about Aleister Crowley, he's a little bit over the top today. I'm just thinking about what we could do to close up. How about we don't lament it? One of the things that I was taught was always make you popular. If you don't have anything to say, knock, 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 get to the door. Everybody gets to socialize, heads to the door, makes yourself enormously popular. So I'm going to do exactly the same thing. Thank you so very much, sincerely, for joining me today. I'm going to put a little bit of music by another Mason up so you can take a listen. And you all might not know, I hope you do, this is one of my favorite songs that he did, Nat King Cole, brother Nat King Cole. And I'll look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, the powers that be, the deities that you follow and subscribe to, and the great architect of the universe, be very generous with you. And you conduct yourself in your lodge as the tender father. Move ahead. Have fun. It will be complete.
sleeping, or I'll never give my heart. And the moment I can feel that, you feel that way too, is when I fall in love with you.
Cheers.